and welcome to EG's Dealmaker of the Month with me, Jim Larkin, where I'm very pleased to be joined by Watling Real Estate Director Jamie Lamond, who, as March drew to a close, sat top of the Radius Individual Dealmaker rankings for the UK with 160,000 square feet of space transacted over the course of the month. Now, Watling is a very interesting company, as it was formed less than a year ago in a management buyout of Avison Young's restructuring team, meaning a core focus of what it does is handling property sales as part of that restructuring process, often on behalf of whichever administrator or receiver has been appointed. This makes Watling a particularly good barometer of the wider macroeconomic picture, and since that's something everyone in commercial real estate is dependent on, especially in these uncertain times, now is a really good time to take a detailed reading. Jamie, welcome aboard. How are you?
Very well, Jim. Thanks for having me along.
Good stuff. Okay. Now, despite some pretty big numbers on the Radius rankings for March, Watling Real Estate is still quite a fledgling company. Can you just explain how it came into existence and how the MBO from Avison Young came together?
Yeah, absolutely. No, you are right. I mean, I'm almost surprised to say the next words, actually, but we are closing in on our first year, and it has gone by with a flash. I think we're 10 and a half months or so in now. But it's been a really, really interesting journey. I've been a bit of a lifer in the large corporate market. This is obviously very different in certain circumstances, but in others, it's very, very similar. And I think we're very lucky for that. It's a bit of a rarity. You know, I myself was at the GVA Grimley, GVA Bilfinger, all the various guys through to Avison Young and then out into Watling over a course of 20 or so years doing transactional services in and outside of the world of restructuring. So a bit of a lifer. But what's quite interesting is quite a lot of my colleagues who are now joining me at Watling are also the same. So whilst, as you say, it's a new brand at Watling, the restructuring team at GVA Avison Young was 30 years old, extremely established and operating across most of the major lenders and accountancy firms that provide administration advisory. So we're very well as a team considered in our market. And of the 26 staff who made up the Avison Young restructuring team, 18 came over. We're now up to 20. So yes, a new brand, but very much business as usual in the background, which has made the transition obviously a lot easier. And we are, you know, we don't obviously do this necessarily for the pat on the back, but it's been a wonderful experience to get the comments and the support we have from our existing client base who have broadly all come over with us. So we hit the ground running, which is great. And we've had some wonderful feedback on the brand, you know, people saying, look, it feels like it's been around a lot longer than indeed it has. So yes, it's been a really interesting journey. You mentioned sort of why. Well, we're an entrepreneurial bunch, as you would expect in the real estate focused industry. The timing was right for us. I think it's something we had been considering. I'd add it was very much supported by Avison Young, and Avison Young remains a very close part of our hearts. We've got lots of friends that remain within that business. Really pleased to hear that they have seemingly worked through some of their financial issues that they've had of late. So it's really good news that business is going to be looking good moving into the future, because we've got lots of good friends that remain in there, and there's some really, really good people that work there. So we continue to work with them quite closely. So they were very supportive of our exit, but certainly the timing was right. There were, to a degree, some sort of perceived and potential conflicts that were starting to grow with our growing business in restructuring and how that potentially had impacts on the wider business. And that had been something that had been brewing in a little bit in the background. Certainly our clients were also sort of keen to see a degree of independence, albeit some of our competitors haven't made the jump to go and do that yet. So again, the independence piece was quite key to us. But broadly, the timing was right. You know, we'd had a couple of years of pretty difficult business. The COVID wasn't kind to us. Lots of people immediately assume when there's a problem, oh well, a restructuring team will do really well. But as you'd expect through a crisis you know, whether it was central government or the banks themselves, they put a lot of measures in place to protect their clients, which meant that the appointments of administrators and receivers was reduced significantly over that period, which obviously had a direct impact on our business. So we had a quiet COVID, dare I say, as many of us did. But subsequently, that our market has been picking up, and it just felt the right time to grab hold of that opportunity, the independence. And here we are, nearly a year in, and Watling is born.
So, I mean, how does it feel to be out on your own rather than as a part of some, you know, massive global organization?
Oh, I mean, huge mixed emotions. I mean, being blunt, and anyone that would say otherwise, I would love to hear, but it was pretty scary, to be honest. It was some jump. It was some jump out. You know, as I mentioned earlier, there's a few of us that are sort of lifers in the corporate model. So it was a bit scary. You know, the spreadsheet at one point, whilst we're working at what we had to do, you know, you get a little complacent in these larger environments because there's always someone there doing your insurance and your marketing and your, you know, all the other bits and bobs that you just have in a big corporate. So we've had to learn how to set up and run a business as well as doing our core business. And I won't lie to you, Jim, it's been a really hard 9 months, in a really good way, but it's been really hard work combining the two, because we have to maintain the standards that our clients expect, but in the same breath find us some extra hours to put the infrastructure and make this credible business. So we've worked really hard. It's been very much a team game. All of us have had a responsibility for certain elements of it, and it's really now, and probably only in the last couple of months, feeling now that it's all, we can breathe a little bit more. It's all there. It's all working, which is lovely. Our industry is, or what we do within the real estate industry, is starting to pick up, and we can now really concentrate on growing the business. And I think we're very well placed, given the world that we are seemingly in and perhaps going into, to pick up some really exciting work opportunities.
Most of the work you do is kind of, well, the focus is on restructuring, and the transactional work is kind of a consequence of that. I mean, how different is that to the, you know, conventional agency world?
Needless to say, there is a good degree of similarities, but actually, as someone who lives in that world, not in isolation, but into a good degree, there are a number of differences. Sort of going back to that sort of corporate business comment that we were talking about a minute ago, and this isn't a criticism, it's more of a fact. When you work in those types of environments, if you work in transactional services, you're typically siloed into an area. You know, it's common that you have an office agency team and in town, out of town, even splitting a retail, industrial. You know what you operate in, and that's what you do. Within the world of restructuring, I consider it a bit of a luxury. Actually, we don't always know what's coming our way, and certainly we cross all sectors. So that is probably one of the primary differences, that we have that opportunity to cross sector and grow our experience or establish our experiences further. There are, without question, a number of challenges and difficulties that distressed real estate bring. There's always a problem in the background, and each one invariably, you know, it sounds simple. Someone has defaulted somewhere and it has led to a process. There are always a number of other cogs that have led to that, which means even if you're selling two almost identical properties in close proximity of each other, the story in the background could indeed be very different. So we get dragged sideways. Our skill set as transactional specialists means that we do get dragged sideways into creating strategies that are very much considered around that very specific situation that we're dealing with. So we do have to divert from a more standardized agency structure quite regularly. We also, without getting too sort of deep into the how insolvency works, but you know, it's primarily split into two. You've got receivership and administration. What a receivership is, defaults on charges and real estate focused. Administration is based on business failure, and for us, where there may be some real estate as part of that. Again, that they bring very different backstories and very different challenges, and there are many, many moving parts which we get involved with.
Okay. Because of, you know, there's always that element of financial distress involved, I'm guessing a lot of potential buyers come sniffing around expecting to find a bit of a bargain. But then I guess it's your job not to let them have one.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We get people from all walks of life because of the range of assets classes, and we'll come on to it. I think we'll be talking hangars shortly. Yes. we have a range of asset types and values, and you know, we're very happy to deal and very well structured to deal with all of that. And you're absolutely right. As soon as someone hears the words administration, receivership, and arguably my name, having been doing this for the best part of 20 odd years, you know, my name comes to a degree with a view that there's going to be an interesting opportunity sitting in the background. But no, your previous question is probably a good precursor to this one. We're very good at what we do, and that's why we get the work that we do. And it is for us, through the strategy that we take on that particular asset, to ensure that we are getting best value for it, because there are a number of people invariably in the background who are disgruntled by the situation. It might be a bank that has a problem. It might be a borrower who, rightly or wrongly, thinks that, you know, the situation that they're now in is whether it's fair or not. You may have secured creditors. You may have unsecured creditors. We operate in quite a litigious environment, as you would expect. And as a result of that, it is absolutely essential that we provide the right advice and we sell things when we are selling at the right price in the market to stave off any criticism from the parties that I've previously mentioned. So we have to take it from a place of people thinking that they might be getting a bargain to ones invariably where they're not. And I think we're pretty good at it for what it's worth. And, you know, the market ultimately sets its levels. You know, we're lucky that a lot of the stuff that we sell ends up in this competitive tension, and we go through bidding processes, and we like that because that helps us demonstrate that the market has set its level and we are selling things at the right value.
Sure. Okay. Is there a kind of extra pressure in the sense that jobs are on the line if you don't get a good result? I mean, I'm thinking in terms of, you know, if a company's in administration and needs kind of properly restructuring, or if a company's gone bust and it will have loads of creditors who are, you know, relying on that money for their survival.
Yeah, so there's two parts to that question. The first bit, gladly, is not the bit that I get involved with. So the administrators are the ones that will deal with a business that is having a few problems. And if there are implications of the issue on staff, etc., that will fall to those effectively accountants that are dealing with the business. Invariably, when I get involved in casework that has come from administrators, they have established what the problems are, and the staff may well have already exited stage left, or they are winding the business down and they've realized that the a core piece of value within that business is the real estate. So invariably we're a later stage to any of that sort of corporate element. And apologies, Jim, what was the second part of that one?
It was more that, you know, the companies and jobs will depend on you getting a good result.
So less so the jobs, but for us, invariably, we will see pressure from creditors to make sure they will want to know that if the main value in the business is an asset, that it's being sold at the right price. Because unfortunately, in a number of occasions, creditors at the end of an administration process don't always win. So we have to do our best to ensure that we're extracting every last penny out of whatever value that there is in that business, to ensure that as many of those creditors get something out of it.
Okay. Now, you sort of alluded to this earlier, but I kind of spoke to a lot of agents about, you know, the state of the world, as you do, and they kind of say, you know, the current economic downturn isn't as bad as kind of previous ones they've lived through, because there aren't kind of the similar levels of companies going into administration. I mean, kind of from your end, have you found that? I mean, and, you know, how tough are things generally?
That is the million-dollar question, and one we're asked to sort of predict on, given the roles that we have, quite regularly, and have really struggled to give a very good answer to. Now, I have worked through a few crises over the last couple of decades, and there is a degree of acceptance in my mind of what they're saying to you. It does feel very different to previous times, but I don't think we're there yet. Certainly, if you look at the number of administration cases in recent months, they have considerably increased, as have the number of appointments of receivers. I don't think it's going to look like the global financial crisis, because that was, there was no money in the market. You know, the lending scene at the moment is so different. You know, all our cool work back in the day used to come from the clearing banks, because that's where the majority of the real estate debt sat. And as a side comment, you know, we're very lucky that we're still on the panels of the majority of them, and they've all sort of welcomed our move over to Watling, which is great. So we still have that exposure to the clearing banks, but they've been really quite quiet because the challenger bank, peer-to-peer lender, other lending market is the arena at the moment where most of the debt is. And we didn't have that last time round. And we're only now starting to experience how these guys, who are structured very differently, are going to play when they experience problems across their debt books. So we're not quite there yet. I think it will be different. I do agree with that. But I think by the end of the year, I think we will be seeing considerable amounts of distressed sales in the market.
Okay. I mean, are there any sectors that seem to be particularly at risk? I mean, I know a lot of kind of pubs and restaurants that were firstly offered furlough and then were offered help with their energy bills, and now they're sort of, you know, they have had all that support pulled away and they're having to kind of deal with reality. I mean, are there any that are kind of seem to be in trouble at the moment?
Well, yeah, you've hit on the nail on the head on one of the main ones. The hospitality sector at the moment is really, really hurting. We're selling a portfolio of pubs in the northeast at the moment. And we're very aware of a number of independents, restaurants, hotel groups who are really, really struggling. And I think we can expect to see an uplift in that further as the year progresses. We're all very aware of how the high street has been hit, not just by COVID, but just changes of shopping habits. That will continue, sadly, and the repurposing of some of these huge buildings. I'm interested to see how that's going to go. We've been lucky to have been dealing with a number of sales of various Houses of Fraser and Debenhams and BHS units, and they're really, really tricky, and they're big, and they sit in some awkward locations. But they are selling. You know, obviously, move to residential. Well supported by the government, albeit some of these conversions are quite tricky. We can see a lot of them probably moving into residential uses. But the individual units on a high street are also very at risk as well. You know, you can walk down most secondary town high streets now, and it's the vacancy is huge. That will continue. We've seen quite a strong rebasing of industrial values in certain locations. Again, we've had the luxury of dealing with a number of assets for companies that have gone into administration. Some, you know, everyone assumes that industrial logistics distribution is still the golden child. It remains so, and it's a very stable sector, but we are seeing through business failure a number of those units come to the market, and there has been a rebasing of values there. And then I think the one that's not fully explored yet, albeit we're now starting to see things that you guys will have reported on in the likes of Canary Wharf in the city, where values have plummeted from 100 plus million down to 30. There are going to be a number of buildings here that are technically underwater, whether it's a loan to value breach, changes in occupation, rental level changes, which mean there are going to be problems in the city in the West End on some core office accommodation. We're only just seeing it. It'll come, so we'll be able to analyse that, I suspect, better as the year progresses. But I think that is going to be a hot spot of problems as we progress.
Sure. Okay. I guess a slightly more optimistic note then.
Yes.
Are you still finding there are plenty of cash-rich buyers out there that are just waiting for the right opportunities to come along?
Absolutely. And again, I think this is another reason why we're going to be in a different process to the global financial crisis, because there was only a handful of people then really in the market as buyers who had the money to go and exploit the situation. There is still plenty of weight of money in the market from those that are sitting on cash reserves. But as I mentioned earlier, there is still a strong interest from a number of lender groups to lend. So across the two, yes, there is plenty of money around. The question is, and the deliberation on most of their lips is when to buy. Is it today? Is it in 6 months or somewhere in between later? So you'll get many answers to that. And I don't think I can give you the perfect one still. but it's those that are trying to predict the right minute to put the money back into the market.
Sure. Okay. And on a slightly related note, how big an issue is ESG within the work you do? regarding, you know, the new EPC rulings that have come in? Because I imagine if, you know, there's a company in receivership, then the receiver isn't going to spend time and money bringing it up to speed if you know, they need to.
Yeah, this is key. So this is going to be really interesting as this plays out. Technically, a receiver is not obliged to add value legally, where it is right to do so. And obviously our strategy will dictate that they will. But some of these buildings now are going to be just very difficult/impossible to justify investing the money in them to add that value. You know, if you're looking at, you know, regional business parks that from the 80s, etc. You know, we had a presentation quite recently to 100 odd clients that we put together, and we had a QS come and join us on a panel. And something that stuck with me that he said was, you know, really, unless the rents are at least £60 a foot, it's extremely difficult to justify the money that needs to go in to bring the ESG up to the level that it's required. Mm. Well, that's a big number if you look at the UK, if you step out of the M25.
Yeah.
You know, and there is a lot of kit out there that is now underoccupied and is perhaps coming to the end of its economic life. And you've got to ask yourself, what is the future of those buildings? Because I think the ESG point is just another challenge that is going to be placed on a lot of this accommodation that we have in the UK. So, yeah, it's going to be significant. And I wait with bated breath to see how it's implemented. But I think it's going to have a detrimental effect on an awful lot of real estate.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, that is. Yeah. I mean, I've heard that it's kind of gone so far up the chain that lenders won't give money to potential buyers unless what they're buying meets certain ESG standards.
So, yeah, that's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. And as soon as it hits that level in the chain, that is going to be a problem for a lot of people, particularly as there's a lot of debt that needs refinancing. And if they can't refinance it, then there's a problem. And that's why I think all these factors, when you put them together, as this year progresses, this is all going to start showing its head. And I think that is why ultimately the Watling team are going to be very busy.
Okay, right. Let's drill down into the deals that you did last month. The biggest, it was the sale of 150,000 square feet of hangar space at Luton Airport. Can you just kind of talk through that in terms of who originally owned that, who called you in, and who the purchaser is?
Yeah, absolutely. Really, really interesting case that has been part of my life for a very long time, actually. So we were acting on behalf originally of KPMG, who were brought in as administrators over the Monarch Airlines business when it collapsed in 2017. So that's how long I've been working on the various guises of the Monarch administration.
You must be pleased to see the back of it. A little bit.
Interestingly, so KPMG's restructuring team spun out a few years ago and set up as Interpath Advisory, to a degree under a larger scale, but under the same sort of pretenses of our spin out of Avis and Young, the sort of perceived conflict. But we've moved along with them, particularly on this case and a number of others, very good clients of ours. So I started off with their, interestingly, in 2017, it was when Monarch went into administration. It was the largest non-wartime repatriation of people from around the globe because of all the people that were stuck out on their on their holidays. So it's one of the interesting statistics of this particular sad demise of a business, where unfortunately all staff, as per your reference earlier, lost their jobs on this one and were sort of repositioned across the aviation sector. But no, we sold a few years ago, a 50,000 square foot office building, which was their HQ, and various other buildings in and around Luton and Birmingham Airport. We sold another, I think it was about 200,000 square foot hangar up in Birmingham that they had as well. Luton was older stock. It's effectively about 150,000 square feet in three hangars, interjoining hangars, airside access to Luton Airport. If anyone's flown out of Luton Airport and been in the terminal there, you'll have, to this day actually, albeit a little faded, see the Monarch logo on the on the hangar doors. When the instruction finally came through for this element of the administration, which was actually a separate company to Monarch Airlines, it was Monarch Airlines Engineering Limited, which was the next stage, to which there was quite a good degree of value in the business and the tooling and et cetera. We came to the market with it, and a good old COVID hit us, which was extremely frustrating. Luton Airport became a bit of a graveyard for aircrafts. There was more aircraft parked up with engine covers on than I've ever seen in my life. You could barely see the tarmac below it. And being very blunt, trying to sell hangars when almost every global aircraft is grounded, you can't leave your home, was a challenge, to say the least. So the marketing process has been extended for quite a decent amount of time. We did actually go under offer on for a couple of occasions to a couple of parties on this, but the aviation sector and the impact during and indeed for a good period of time post COVID, whilst everything was sort of trying to resurrect itself, just meant that we couldn't practically close these deals. So it did go on for a little while. I don't know how much you know about Luton Airport, but they have been investing quite significantly in it. They've put a monorail in now from Luton Parkway Station, connecting it to the terminal. Previously, you had to get a taxi or a bus, which wasn't ideal. They've built a very large new car park, which sadly you may have seen in the press recently burnt to the ground when a car caught fire in it. Yeah. And they've made huge improvements to the existing terminal. So the infrastructure improvements that are going on up there are quite significant, which has led them, very pleasingly, to come to us and say, actually, we'd quite like to buy these hangars because of X, Y, and Z reasons, our relationships with their incumbent airlines, et cetera, and they could see good value in it. So I'm really pleased that what we've done is forming part of their wider infrastructure improvements. And they're going to be investing heavily in these hangars, which is required to bring them up to a modern standard. So airlines can use them for effectively storage or an MRO facility, which is mechanical overhaul repairs. So it's going to be really nice to see at some point in the future when flying out of there, something I've been involved in for many, many years, looking nice and shiny again.
Cool. How do you go about pricing an aircraft hangar? I would have no clue. I mean, do you treat it as essentially as logistics space? Or?
No, there is enough transactional evidence in the market of hangars. I think to a degree by accident, that dating back to probably our GVA days, we have been quite involved in a lot of aviation real estate over the years. We had involved back in the day, I think it probably started with XL Airlines demise at Gatwick Airport. We've had involvement with obviously Monarch, Flybe. We leased a big hangar up in Manchester off the back of the Thomas Cook demise. So as a team, we're actually quite savvy in that in that sector, which was helpful for this instruction, and I suspect will probably lead to us getting involved in some other interesting aviation focused real estate in the future.
Yeah, I mean it's been a tough few years for aviation. I mean, I think they struggled almost uniquely through COVID. I mean, have you kind of had any others besides Monarch that have come out since COVID?
So for us, the other big one of our involvement was Thomas Cook. There are, you'll appreciate the nature of the work that I do. There are some others that we have been involved with, which are not in the public domain.
Fair enough.
If I may be so bold in saying, but yes, we have had other interests.
Sure. Okay. And your other deal, I think we've got, is for One Polytechnic Street in Woolwich, which you sold for $2 million. What was that building?
This actually falls off the back of some other stuff. So I sold fairly recently an office PD to Resi scheme in West London of 300 residential units. It was a big sale that happened not that long ago. And off the back of that ownership, that administration and ownership structure, there was this building over in Woolwich on Polytechnic Street, which was another 40-odd flats. But it also had 10,000 square feet of commercial accommodation in it and three apartments that hadn't been completed correctly in the eyes of the planners. And that's another example of where we get pulled a little bit sideways in terms of our transaction advisory. So I haven't got consent at this stage to say who's bought it, it's got an educational use and it is going to be operated as a sort of an outpost faculty for a nearby educational institution. So it's going to be nice to see it come to life with a number of kids learning in a new build environment, which will be better, as I understand it, from where they're coming out of, which will be really great for them moving forward. we've been dealing with these flats and getting the planning finalised and some plant issues resolved, etc., and disposing of those to get the last elements of this wider administration closed down in terms of elements that can be sold, so the administrators can effectively then exit. But a really interesting case.
Yeah. No, I just love the fact there is a Polytechnic Street. You don't hear that word anymore, do you?
You do not hear it anymore. Yes, it may be one of one.
Yeah, everything's university now. I think my primary school is now university.
I know.
Anyway, how big a part of the stuff you do is the non-restructuring side of things? I mean, do you do anything that would be termed, you know, conventional agency?
Yeah, absolutely. It's an interesting one. And I'm really glad we're having this conversation now because we, being blunt, and it's something we're learning, I think, is setting up on our own. We've never been, as part of the wider corporate structure, been very good at shouting from the rooftops about what we do. We also do, I should say, have a challenge in a number of occasions where we're just simply not permitted to shout it from the rooftops, because you'll understand that there is a bank who has an issue and they don't really want it shouted from the rooftops. And similarly, and very understandably, borrowers who have a problem also do not want that necessarily published to too high a degree. So there is a good proportion of the work that we carry out that unfortunately I can't get registered with you to help me up on my league tables. but we are very busy in the background doing it. But certainly for us, and a huge area of growth for the Watling business is the wider transactional work that we do. I haven't actually strictly got a statistic of what the split is. If I was to guesstimate, it's probably 70-30, 30% being A and other, and that forms, you know, we've sold over the years an awful lot of kit to an awful lot of people, and those relationships existed, and they very kindly, as investors, high net wealths, funds, private equity businesses that we've worked with, very kindly come back to us and say, look, you know, either can you help us again with the same asset, or indeed we've got something else that we'd like some advice and some assistance with. And again, that can range across all asset types. But yes, we're very busy with other stuff as well. And Watling has big plans for 2024 in terms of growth generally as a business. I think our core business will grow anyway, naturally, just because of the cycle that we're in. We have already employed two new guys, so we're up to 20 staff now. The Watling network is across, in fact, where the name came from, actually. So we've got offices in London, Birmingham, Manchester and Leeds, and the old Roman Road, Watling Street, which I can almost see out of my window here, actually, winds its way from Watling Street in the city and takes in all of our regional outposts. So one of our sort of USPs as a business is, if you have real estate in the Northeast, you will get one of my colleagues who is a Northeast specialist dealing with it as a Watling employee, as opposed to me dealing with it out of London. So it's that proper regional expertise and presence. And across all of our outposts, we have relationships with all of groups that I mentioned, whether it's private equity, just high net wealth, etc. And we operate in transactional, normal, conventional transactional services across all of our offices.
Sure. Okay. So, I mean, what are your kind of plans for 2024 and beyond? I mean, you kind of mentioned that you've kind of now feel like you've, you know, you can breathe a little bit and you're kind of set up. Are you now looking ahead and looking at which areas you want to grow in?
Yeah, absolutely. And it sort of ties in nicely with what we were just talking about. Certainly the immediate focus is transactional services. So we've gone from 18 to 20 now. We've brought Ian Whittaker in our Manchester office, who is an investment agent specialist, capital markets. He's already significantly growing our offering, and the plan is to expand that across the Birmingham and London teams. So very much focused on that. I think as we get busier in terms of the restructuring work that we do, I think we came across as a lean team, as you'd expect on day one, you know, sense check the market, see what direction we're going in. But certainly, I think we all agree that we are going to need additional support in the restructuring model. So growth is the plan as we move into 2024.
Good stuff. OK. And I also I believe your kind of London office, you're working out of Flex Space on Cannon Street.
We are indeed.
How are you finding that? And are there plans to kind of find a more permanent home?
Yeah, that's a really interesting one, because we're coming up to our first year here. So we do need to think about what we're doing. It's really different. You know, you get very used to sitting in 40,000, 50,000 square feet and having the amenities around you, and you take it for granted. So moving into serviced offices was really unusual. We've got a really lovely room where I'm sitting talking to you today. I've got a lovely view over St. Paul's and the Bloomberg building in the middle of the city. It's a lovely spot. I have to be honest, we really enjoy it. And I could see this being something that we continue with, certainly in the short term, because we've got so much to do as part of our core business and running our own business that just having someone else deal with rents, rates, service charge, light bulbs, you know, cleaning, all the rest of it, just takes, it's just something off the list. We also have the luxury of, you know, Avis & Young had lots of wonderful departments which we can engage with, but here we've got lots of other businesses around us. So just the chat at the coffee station or in the lift has opened up some really interesting conversations with people that you wouldn't necessarily get to engage with in a big corporate building. So I think I do speak for all of us, and we're in other than our Birmingham office, we're in serviced offices everywhere. And I think everyone pretty much enjoys it, actually. It's good. It works very well for us.
Excellent. OK. And just finally, fun one to finish on. If you had a magic wand, what would be the first thing you did with it to kind of really help out your particular corner of commercial real estate?
God, that's an interesting one. You know, you shouldn't wish your life away, should you? The last 10 months have gone by really, really quickly. And I think that surprised all of us. And it's been, our move has been really well received in the market. And when I say don't want to sort of wish your life away, I think we're all just so eager to take this business forward and grow it and see the success, which I think we will. I believe that we will. So the magic wand, to a degree, probably is just to slow everything down a little bit and allow us to understand how this market is likely to change over the coming quarters. I want to get to the point whereby we can actually start interviewing and growing our transactional capital markets part of the business.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Well, on that hopeful note, I think we'll bring things to a close. That's Jamie, good. Thank you ever so much for your time. That was great.
Thanks, Jim. Lovely. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.